precious Lindy. I will never think of you again, I promised, swore, lied. Then I pulled the trigger. A fine mist, blood and brains in my hair, the men in black surging forward. I won, I thought. I lost, I already understood. Then a woman was standing there. Flora, it's okay. Flora. Flora? My name is S.A.C. Kimberly Quincy. I'm here to take you home. I felt sorry for her because I already understood that the Flora everyone once knew and loved would never be going home again. There was simply me. And I didn't even know who that was anymore.
Chapter 42. By the time Dee Dee arrived at Tonic, the nightclub was in full swing. Music so loud the blacked-out walls vibrated with the beat of the bass, a dance floor crowded with writhing bodies, strobing blue lights casting everything into a surreal glow of moving parts. Dee Dee cut through the line outside by virtue of her badge, then worked her way around the outskirts of the dance floor until she came to the hall leading to the manager's office. Sure enough, Jocelyn Ethier sat inside wearing the same black top and black slacks from earlier, except she was not alone. Across from her sat Keynes. Dee Dee drew up short, and not because the victim specialist had finally traded in his trademark suit for some ridiculously expensive designer jeans, but because there was no good reason for Keynes to be here. As in, what the hell? As in, what was he once again not telling her? Evening, she drawled from the doorway. F.E.A. looked up, pale face shuttered, which only heightened Dee Dee's tension. Keynes, on the other hand, smiled, contained, mysterious. Dee Dee hated that smile. Didn't realize you were into the club scene, she said pointedly. I was in the area. Funny. Me too. Would you care to join us? Keynes waved a hand as if inviting her to his party. In contrast to Ethie, his expression was open. Dee Dee didn't buy it for a moment. She stepped into the room warily. Her left hand drifted automatically to her hip, where once she'd carried a sidearm. Except she wasn't permitted to carry anymore. She was a restricted duty desk sergeant out on her own. I had some follow-up questions, Keynes said. Really? Dee Dee eyed the manager. So do I. F.E.A. sighed, appeared less than happy. If both of you could come back tomorrow, it'll only take a minute, Keynes said. Only a minute, Dee Dee echoed. A minute? Have you seen the bar? This is peak hours. Look, I don't mean to be rude. Then don't, Keynes said. He was staring right at the woman. And just for a moment, Dee Dee saw Ethie hesitate, as if responding to the power of a handsome man's gaze, or as if receiving an unspoken signal. Once again, her hand drifted toward her hip. Once again, there was nothing there. Keynes caught the motion, and she would have sworn he knew exactly what she was thinking. I was just asking some more questions about Natalie Draga, Keynes said, the first victim. She implied she didn't know Natalie very well, Dee Dee murmured. I don't, the manager began, but perhaps someone on your staff does, Keynes continued smoothly, a fellow bartender, best friend. It's important. The sooner you find that person for us, the sooner we'll be out of your hair. F.E.A. scowled, shifted from side to side. Larissa, she stated abruptly. She's another bartender. She and Natalie often took their breaks together. Is she working tonight? Keynes asked. Yes. Then why don't you fetch her for us? F.E.A. hesitated, clearly reluctant. Then, when Keynes continued to stare at her, Fine, I'll get her. But keep your questions short. It's killer band night. Can't you see how busy it is out there? The manager rose, pushing her way past Dee Dee. A second later, she disappeared down the hall, leaving Dee Dee alone with Keynes. She was already turning on him when he spoke first. Something about our first conversation with her kept bothering me, he said. You mean other than her obvious lie about her relationship with Goulding? Yes. because covering up a past relationship with a suspected rapist is a logical thing to do, not necessarily a sign of guilt. Whatever. Dee Dee kept her voice hard. She remained suspicious. And something else. Frightened? No. Wary. 5 years, Keene said abruptly. Jocelyn Fier said she'd been the manager here for the past 5 years. So? Except then Dee Dee got it. 5 years, as in exactly how long Flora's been home. It could be a coincidence, Keene said. Sure. Except I did some digging. You know where F.E.A. worked 5 years ago? Dee Dee shook her head. It was an obvious question, and no, she and her team hadn't gotten that far. She managed another bar. In Tampa, Florida. Now Dee Dee's heart accelerated in her chest. Florida? As in Jacob's home state? Think it's still a coincidence? No. But why did you send her out of the room? So we could compare notes. I could tell you were suspicious. You sent her away. As in, how do you know she's coming back? Keynes's eyes widened. Dee Dee didn't bother to wait. She was already bolting down the hall. Chapter 43. Stacy moans again in the hallway. In search of attic access, I pause, kneeling by her side, uncertain of what to do. Her side looks terrible, a mass of bloody flesh and wooden splinters, infected, inflamed, why not? But I don't think that injury alone would cause her this much distress. My best guess remains that something more has gone wrong, some kind of internal damage I can't see. A slow bleed? Invisible but deadly? I consider moving her out of the hallway. Sooner or later, the stairwell door will open, our captor returning from wherever to come storming down the corridor, enraged at our escape, prepared to cow us once again into submission, or exact further revenge. It's only a matter of time. Stacy moans again. I need to think quicker, act faster. If she has some kind of internal damage, chances are dragging her from room to room will only make things worse. Instead, I bring the shredded mattress over to her. I prop her head onto one corner. Maybe the sedative-laced foam will put her to sleep. Maybe she'll be grateful for the escape. The musty, grassy odor teases at me again, a sense of déjà vu. I should know what this is. Then it comes to me. Standing in a bar, drinking a beer. Hops. The mattress smells of hops. Reeks of them, really. I'd read about hops while researching various herbal remedies and basic first aid. Hops have been used as a sleep aid since medieval times, when people realized the workers in the hops fields had a tendency to fall asleep on the job. Now, some companies even sell hops pillows for better sleeping, that sort of thing. The science behind it is still sketchy, but I read one report that said if the hops are distilled down to a strong enough extract and then mixed with viburnum root, it boosts effectiveness. So that's the trick, then. The mattress has been treated with hops and viburnum. Easy enough to do if you have access to hops. Say, Devin Goulding, bartender extraordinaire, coming to get me from beyond the grave? I killed him, I remind myself, which seems to be my theme for the day. I killed Jacob, I killed Devin, and yet here I am, kidnapped and locked away with a dying girl. For someone who keeps killing people, I am just not getting the job done. The thought angers me, kickstarts me back into action. I leave Stacy on one side of the hall, head on the hop-soaked mattress. Then I start my search for the attic in earnest, room by room, eyeing ceiling panels. Boston is known for its triple-deckers, three-story homes built narrow and deep, perfect for wedging into skinny rectangular lots. This floor's layout, hallway in the middle, bedrooms either side, is consistent with that. If my assumption is right, the hall should end in a common room with front-facing bay windows, but maybe that part has been walled off. As for which level I'm on, top level makes the most sense, more isolated, no one above to be disturbed by the screams below. I start by going room to room, gazing overhead. The bedrooms are tough. The rubbery black paint obscures everything. I'm not studying a ceiling as much as trying to dissect a Teflon pan. I can't see anything. I return to the hallway, where the water-stained drywall is just as disappointing.
Stacy is still moaning, moaning, moaning. I rub my temples, feeling a rising tide of stress and anxiety. I'm trapped. We're trapped. Four rooms and a hallway. It doesn't matter the size of the cage. Quantity of real estate makes little difference when there's still no way out. I should return to the broken window. I'll finish removing the glass, beat against the plywood. Maybe I can knock it loose. With what? A ramming mattress? A tightly coiled spring? An elbow that is still bruised from my last attempt? Think, think, think! My apartment, top corner of my landlord's triple-decker, where the attic access panel is at the landing at the top of the stairs. And that quickly my heart sinks, because I'm pretty sure I know where the stairs are, on the other side of the locked metal fire door. Stacy's head is thrashing from side to side on the mattress. She is dying from my stupidity. Boarded up window it is. Except at that moment I hear it, a sound. Not the thundering of my own heart or Stacy's labored breath, a creak from down the hall, on the opposite side of the door. There it is again, and again. Someone is coming up the stairs. Chapter 44. Dee Dee had just made it down the hall when Ethie appeared, pulling a tall blonde with puffy hair and a micro-mini in her wake. Dee Dee drew up short, hand on her hip, feeling, if anything, more bewildered than before. The manager stared at her questioningly. "Larissa Roberts," she said, introducing the blonde. "I think it will be easiest to talk in my office." She passed by Dee Dee and then Keynes, who was halfway down the hall. He exchanged a glance with Dee Dee. Both fell in step behind the manager and her charge. Neither said a word. "So you knew Natalie Draga?" Dee Dee said at last when they'd all returned to the very tight office. She was trying to regroup, uncertain whom to study hardest. Jocelyn Ethie, who she was pretty sure might be Jacob Ness's long-lost daughter, or the new girl Larissa, who apparently had been friends with the first victim. She did her best to split her attention between the two, mostly interested in Ethie's reaction to anything Larissa had to say. "Natalie and I were friends," Larissa volunteered now. "Hung out together, that sort of thing. But Natalie, she wasn't big on the personal stuff. I always had the impression this place was just one more stop along the way. When she didn't return, I wasn't surprised."
"Where'd you two hang out?"
Keynes asked.
"Well, during work hours in the break room. But after hours, we might go out, grab a drink, that sort of thing."
"Favorite places?" Dee Dee asked.
"Birches, Hashtag. There's lots of bars around here. We'd wander."
"Devon ever join you?" Dee Dee kept her gaze on Ethie, determined to catch some sign of jealousy, rage.
"Sure. Devon liked Natalie. Anyone could see that. She was gorgeous, of course. But she could be edgy, you know? She played him. Would offer a smile one second, then cut him down the next. She called him her puppy dog. Definitely didn't take him seriously. But as for him, I think he thought it was all very serious. And the more she rebuffed him, the more determined he became. He wanted her, she didn't want him," Dee Dee filled in, still watching Ethie. The manager appeared bored. Nothing here she didn't already know? Or she was that good at wearing a mask?
"Oh, I wouldn't say that. I came upon Natalie with Devon a couple of times in the supply closet. Natalie might have liked to look down her nose at him in public, but behind closed doors, apparently even the buff bot would do."
Ethie had turned her attention to the computer screen, was frowning at something on the monitor. So far, details of Devon Goulding's affair with another woman seemed to mean nothing to her.
"How long did they know each other?"
Keynes asked Larissa.
"Not sure. I mean, most of the time Natalie worked here, Devon was chasing her, but she didn't stay that long. Couple of months? Like I said, she was just passing through."
"What brought Natalie to Boston?" Dee Dee asked.
"Change of pace. She said she was tired of Florida, though how you can tire of sun and sand."
"Florida? I thought she was from Alabama."
Larissa shook her head.
"I never heard her mention Alabama. And while she did have a bit of an accent, not Alabama, nothing as heavy as Alabama."
"Is that how you knew her then?"
Dee Dee asked abruptly, attention zeroing in on F.E.A.
Natalie came here looking for you, didn't she? She felt comfortable asking for a job after her time working for you in Florida.
F.E.A. looked up from the monitor, blinked her eyes.
What?
Florida. You worked in Florida before moving here. Why didn't you mention that before?
You never asked.
What brought you to Boston?
A promotion. This is a better job.
Did you read about Flora Dane?
Keen's now, piling on. Her story was in all the papers. Her return home to Maine. At least in the beginning, the talk of her returning to school in Boston.
I have no idea. That must have rankled.
Dee Dee now, pulling the manager's attention away, keeping her disoriented.
She kills your father and everyone hails her as a hero. Strong, brave girl who saved herself.
What the hell are you talking about?
Larissa shrunk back, clearly wanting out of this sudden change in conversation, but having no place to go.
When did you first sleep with Devon?
Big hunky guy like that. Must have felt good to wrap him around your little finger. Until, of course, Natalie showed up, took his attention away from you. Is that when you decided she must pay? And to make your revenge that much sweeter, you forced Devon to help.
Wait a second. She didn't sleep with Devon.
Larissa, suddenly speaking up. Dee Dee and Keynes both paused, stared at her. The blonde flushed, fiddled with the hem of her skirt.
Jocelyn was never involved with Devon, if that's what you're asking.
She was involved with me. At least when Natalie first arrived, Jocelyn and I were together.
I'm the one...
The girl paused, looked down.
I'm the one who messed everything up. Not Natalie, not Devon. They had nothing to do with our breakup. That was my fault. All my fault.
Dee Dee frowned, studied the manager, who was now bright red with embarrassment.
Management is not supposed to get involved with staff,
F.E.A. said tightly.
If my bosses found out...
You were never involved with Devon Goulding? Dee Dee asked.
Needless to say, not my type.
And Natalie Draga?
Well, more my type, but to be honest...
F.E.A. glanced at Larissa.
I prefer blondes.
How old are you? Keynes asked abruptly.
34.
And your parents?
Roger and Denise F.E.A. live in Tampa. Do you want to call them?
Dee Dee looked over at Keynes.
I don't think she's the one.
No, he agreed. And yet all roads lead back to this bar. The victims, Devon Goulding. She stared at F.E.A., stared at Larissa, willing them to help her.
What aren't you telling us? For the sake of Natalie, Stacy, and Flora, what are we still missing?
Chapter 45.
Glass shard. I still have it in my hand. I wipe my palm on my bare leg, then tighten my grip. Studying the door, calculating which way it will open. The lights. I've turned them on in all the bedrooms to aid with my search. Now I jog quickly down the corridor, snapping off switches before they can give me away. Stacy is muttering, twitching, no time to hide her. But maybe her presence in the hall isn't a bad thing. The noise will distract our captor. While he peers down the hall, trying to figure out who's moaning, what's going on, I can make my move. Attack, then evade. It's as good a plan as any. I'm ready. I focus on the door, breath held, ears tuned for more footsteps. My efforts are soon rewarded. The floorboard creaks right on the other side of the door. He has reached the landing. I crouch low, glass shard in hand. I keep my eyes peeled on the barely visible doorknob, a slight silver gleam in the now darkened hall. The door will open toward me, into the corridor. Plan A. Trip up my attacker and dart through, yanking the door shut behind me and leaving my captor as trapped as I had once been. From there, I'd have smooth sailing down the stairs out into the free world where I could flag down help. Plan B. Fight like hell. I have surprise, training, and a shard of glass on my side. Wars had been won with less. The door rattles slightly. I hear the rasp of a metal bolt being pulled back, unlocking the door from the outside. And now? The handle turns. I will myself to be lower, smaller, invisible in the dark, as the door pushes open. 1 inch. 2. 3. Enough that I could get a foot in to block it. The door opens, A figure fills the void, and then I spring forward, clutching the glass dagger close to my chest as I lash out with my foot, and oomph as the person falls, not forward into the corridor as I'd hoped, but backward onto the equally dark landing. No time to think, no time to redirect. The heavy metal door is already swinging shut as I suck in my stomach and slide through. A dark void to my left. Stairs, I think, twisting toward them, just as a hand snaps around my ankle. A woman's voice sings out, "Molly, it's been so long." Stacy Summers has been telling the truth all along. Outside our locked rooms, things are much, much worse.
"Tell us about Natalie Draga," Dee Dee said at last. "She was the first victim, and the one Devon kept the most photos of. You were her friend." She turned to Larissa. "What should we know about her?"
"I don't know. She was pretty, but kind of dark, really. Her sense of humor, it could be cutting. Honestly, I thought that was one of the things Devon liked about her. She was one of those women who, even when you had her, you didn't know where you stood. She'd say something awful to him one minute, then throw her arms around him the next."
"She'd talk about her personal life? Time in Florida?"
"No.
Mother, father, brothers, sisters, family?
Never."
"I have her file," FEA spoke up. "But to be honest, there's not much in here either."
Dee Dee reached across the desk for it, discovering inside the required government paperwork, a sheet of personal information, and a check dated nearly 9 months ago, confirming that Natalie Draga had left her job one day, never to return. As the manager had warned, the sheet of personal info was scant in its contents. The top of the page contained Natalie's full name in looping script. After that, emergency contact, which was blank, then a phone number, which, according to FEA, was disconnected, followed by a physical address that took Dee Dee only a moment to place as the official location of the Massachusetts State House in downtown Boston. She glanced up at FEA, who shrugged. "We're only required to ask for an employee's information, not to verify it. Around here, lots of people are new to the city or just passing through. As long as they show up on time and work hard, it's good enough for me."
Dee Dee went back to the file, the top of the form where Natalie had scrawled her full name, Natalie Molly Draga, middle name Molly, which rang a bell. She'd recently heard the name Molly. Who'd she been talking to? It came to her, and when it did, Dee Dee's gaze went straight to Keene's.
"Molly, that's the name Jacob Ness gave to Flora," Dee Dee stated.
After Jacob served time for raping a 14-year-old girl, Malia, Molly to her friends. Keynes took the file from her. She could have had a child. Certainly she'd have good reason not to include Jacob's name on the birth certificate. Dee Dee got out her phone. She dialed Phil first, who was her expert on database searches. Keynes provided Malia's full name. Phil did the honors of searching hospital databases in Florida. He came back in a matter of minutes.
"Malia Dragone. Gave birth to a daughter, same year as the sexual assault. Oh, and get this. A year later, I have a record of Malia legally changing her last name to Draga. Her mom did as well. How much you want to bet the whole family was looking for a fresh start?"
After Malia gave birth to Jacob Ness's child, who at this stage of her life would now be an older, manipulative female, her father's daughter, recently moved to Boston to do some hunting on her own. Dee Dee turned to Larissa.
"Tell us, right now, where does Natalie live?"
"I don't know, I never went. She had to have mentioned something. Come on, think. Where did Natalie go at the end of your wanderings?"
"The T station. Wait, I can tell you the line. Oh, I know which subway line she took."
Chapter 46. I don't think. I move. I hear her voice, Lindy's voice, for the first time in years, and it triggers an immediate wave of horror, rage, guilt, terror. I don't have to think about it. I kick hard, connecting with the side of her head. Her hand loosens around my ankle. I flee. No thought, blind panic. I thunder down the stairs, heart racing, pulse pounding. In the back of my mind, an internal voice is yelling at me, "Stop. Take a stand. Fight. This is the moment I've dreamed about. Even imagined during every single self-defense or target shooting class, finally coming face to face with Lindy again. Except this time I'd get it right.
No more dropping the kitchen knife. No more being pinned to the floor while she sat on my chest and outlined what she was going to do with me. No. In my wildest fantasies, I slayed the beast. I did what I should have done years ago. A woman with promises left to keep. Except the truth is, 5 years of training later, I still haven't headed to Florida in search of Lindy, because 5 years later, she still terrifies me. She's laughing. The sound drifts down the stairs behind me as I round the first landing and keep on trucking. Beneath my hand, the railing is wooden and wobbly, clearly in need of repair. Old home, I was right about that. I have to find the door, make it to ground level, locate the front door, and flee into the night, leaving Stacy Summers behind with Jacob's beloved daughter and favorite partner in crime. I hit the bottom. No more stairs, just a dark, enclosed space. With no lights, it's hard to get my bearings. I think I'm in a small foyer, not unlike the one in my apartment building. As my eyes adjust further, I can make out an open doorway to my right, where I can peer through to the lighter shadows of other rooms. Then I identify another opening to my left, leading to yet another corridor. This confuses me. I've been picturing a traditional triple-decker layout in my head. In that case, the stairs should be at one end of the building, not in the middle, meaning this probably isn't a triple-decker, meaning I have no idea where I am, after all, or where the front door might be. Play the odds. Doors have a tendency to lead directly to the stairs, hence, straight across from me should be an egress. At least, that's the best place to start. I approach with my arms outstretched, feeling for a doorknob. Behind me I hear groaning wood as Lindy begins her descent. Come on, come on, come on. There must be a door, any kind of exit. Come on! I feel wood panels. Then to my left, the thin outline of a hinge. My hands fly to the right, and lo and behold, knob. I have located the doorknob. I twist, yank, and... nothing. The door doesn't open, doesn't budge. It's locked. My fingers fly around the knob, searching for latches to twist, bolts to undo. I find one, then two, a second twist, a second yank. The door moves, rattles in the frame, but it doesn't open. Something is still connected, a bolt, a chain, something I haven't found yet. I remember the doors of the upstairs rooms, then stretch up, 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 and sure enough I find it. Them. Two more bolts latched tight at the top of the doorframe. I whimper. I can't help myself. The stairs creaking right behind me. I'm running out of time. And then... she's here.
I got a T-line, Dee Dee announced to Neil over the phone.
FEA and Larissa had vacated the office, given Dee Dee and Keen space to work. She rattled off the information to Neil, heard the scratching sound of him taking notes.
Combine that with our other requirements, plus frequent destinations on Goulding's GPS, and give me the address.
It doesn't help, Neil said.
What do you mean it doesn't help?
I mean nothing makes sense.
Her favorite red-headed detective sounded frustrated.
I've been over and over the vehicle's list of frequent destinations. None of them match our location profile, with or without subway lines included.
But that doesn't make any sense, Dee Dee said.
Told you so. He had to have used his vehicle, right?
She paused, backing up and revisiting their original logic. Across from her, Keynes nodded encouragingly. The night Goulding abducted Flora, he knocked her out, loaded her in his vehicle, drove her home, right?
He knocked her out, Neil supplied, meaning she didn't know how he transported her home. She was unconscious.
But you can see that trip in his car, right? It would be his last drive.
Hang on.
Okay, Friday night, car journeyed from downtown Boston to home address. His abduction of Flora, where, of course, he used his personal vehicle for transport. It's not like you can take an unconscious girl on the T or dump her into a taxi, so he's got to be using his vehicle for at least the initial kidnapping.
Okay, Neil agreed.
Parking garages. Keynes mouthed across from her. Dee Dee nodded, then repeated the words into the phone.
If Devin's driving someplace all the time, he'd need to park. What about parking garage passes, memberships, something like that?
A pause. She could hear Neil talking to someone, most likely Carol on the other end of the phone.
No monthly payments to a parking garage, Neil reported shortly.
Really? But that doesn't
make any sense.
Both she and Neil sighed heavily.
They were close. Dee Dee could feel it. Just one last connection, deduction, and then...
Flora and Stacy Summers at the mercy of Jacob Ness's daughter. Dee Dee shuddered just thinking about it.
Oh! Ooh! Neil said suddenly.
What?
Carol has a point. Maybe it's not separate.
What do you mean?
The location. Maybe it's not unique. For example, we wouldn't notice him driving to work, right? Because that's his job. Of course he's going there.
He's not holding four women in a nightclub, Dee Dee said, though her gaze drifted up to the black-painted ceiling.
She shook her head. She was being ridiculous. They'd been here during the day, when the nightclub had shed its blue lights and was a tired but definitely very busy shell. Given the number of people passing through at any time, cleaning up, restocking, prepping, no way three kidnapped girls would go unnoticed.
So not his job, Neil was saying, but another logical destination no one would think to question.
Dee Dee got it.
Jim. He's always working out, and most of those huge 24-hour fitness clubs are located in South Boston near the water, Neil filled in, where, in the name of gentrification, half of the area is being demolished and the other half rebuilt. I got an address for the gym. Even better, Carol says it's right by some of the boarded-up tenement houses which are still waiting to be torn down.
He rattled off the gym's location.
Thank you, Neil.
Then, not even grudgingly,
and you too, Carol.
Dee Dee hung up the phone. Then she and Keynes were on the move. Chapter 47
I've been looking for you, Lindy sing-songs as she pads across the landing, through the right-hand doorway, deeper into the building after me. I flee first, forcing myself away from a locked door into the rest of the building. I think I'm in a living room. I can just make out the shape of a sofa, table, chairs, maybe a ground-floor apartment, long and narrow. I try to create some kind of blueprint in my mind to guide me as I creep deeper into the gloom. The windows here must be boarded up as well. It's the only way to explain the total darkness. I make it through a second doorway into another shadowed hall. I halt on the other side, my back pressed against the wall. I still have my shard of glass from the broken window. I clutch it to my chest and try to get my breathing under control before the sound of my own panic gives me away. Time to focus. Time to pull it together. I'm not Jacob's terrified little mouse anymore. I'm a woman with promises left to keep.
I read all about your last day with my dad, Lindy is saying now. Her voice comes from behind me, in the first room, I think, near the sofa. Bullet through the head.
Did he beg for you to do it? I knew if they caught him, he was never going back.
I don't say anything. Deep breath in, deep breath out. I'm not tired, I'm not hungry, I'm not cold, I am okay.
I worried in the beginning, thought the police might come looking for me. So I disappeared for a bit, spent some time in Texas, Alabama, California, saw more of the country. I figured Jacob would approve.
Her voice is closer. Deep breath in, deep breath out, I can do this.
But you didn't tell them about me, did you, Flora? You kept our time together to yourself. Our special little secret.
I squeeze my eyes shut, bite my lower lip to silence the whimper. She's right. I never told. Not that piece of the puzzle. The shame? The horror? I don't know. But all survivors have their secrets. Things we can't say out loud because that makes what happened too real. Not just to other people, but especially to ourselves. Samuel suspected something. He dangled bait during our initial sessions, but I never gave in. No one wants to be a monster, and certainly no one wants to talk about it later.
I thought I would let you go,
Lindy continues now. She's drifted to the left, not moving forward, but now into the kitchen area, prowling around the table and chairs.
But I just couldn't. The fact you were still alive and doing well while Jacob... I don't expect you to understand, but I know that you, of all people, realize just how special Jacob's and my relationship was. No one ever knew me the way he did, and no one ever accepted him the way I did. He was my father, and I was his Lindy, a special nickname he made up just for me first time he saw me. Natalie belonged to my mother, but Lindy, I was his, and you, little bitch.
had no right to take him from me. Her voice so close it's nearly in my ear. She's right behind me. Other side of the wall, I realize. No more breathing. I suck in all the air, hold it in my lungs, will myself not to make a sound.
Last year, I decided it was time to get serious. I came looking for you. Paid a visit to your mother's farm. She was easy enough to track down using the internet.
Did she ever tell you that? Mention an old friend who stopped by?
She's a tight one. No matter what I tried, she wouldn't answer any questions about you. Best I could get is that you lived in Boston. So I decided to move here, too.
Why not? Nice change of pace for a southern girl like me.
I got a job, prepared to settle in while I continued to look for you. And then I met him. Devon. A man who didn't even know what kind of man he was, but I knew. I recognized him immediately. And then it was easy enough to bring him along. I set up the house. I let him make me its first occupant. Then I sent him in search of more playmates. Because a girl like me has certain appetites, as you know better than anyone.
I shake uncontrollably. I hate the response. Primal. Visceral. But the more she talks, the more it all comes back. Those terrible nights, the noises, the taste of bile. I'm not okay, I'm not okay, I'm not okay. I'm Molly again, and I'm not going to make it.
You killed him, too, didn't you? I went to Devon's house Saturday morning. He never stopped by after work, never called. I knew he was getting restless. I had told him he had to lie low after getting caught on video. Sloppy. We had to rein things in, keep it tight. But that's the problem with trained dogs. Sometimes they fight the leash. So I went to Devon's house to check up on him, and what did I discover? All those police cars, the crime scene tape. You. I saw you sitting in the back of the patrol car, garbage smeared all over your face, and just like that I knew what you'd cost me. Again. Did you really think I'd just let you go? Walk away a second time? That I wouldn't follow you back to your place? That I wouldn't hang out on the fire escape, waiting until your landlords had stepped out to come back down, pick the lock to their apartment, and steal the master keys? Then, when all was quiet, I unlocked the door and walked straight into your apartment. A little chloroform cocktail to disorient, a quick shot of sedative to knock you out completely, and that was that. I replaced the keys in your landlord's apartment, then hustled you down to my own personal taxi. I drive it at nights, the perfect way to earn extra cash while cruising the streets for fresh opportunities. No one notices a taxi driver. No one even questions one loading a stumbling, disoriented woman into the back of the cab. Poor thing is drunk. Good thing a taxi is taking her home. Now, everything is exactly as Daddy would have wanted it to be. You and me together again. Except this time I'm the one with the gun, and you're the one who will never leave. You're mine. You'll always be mine, Lindy whispers, and just like that she's in the doorway, right beside me. I don't need light to know there's a smile on her face. No more thinking, no planning, no preparation. She might have found me first, but that doesn't mean I didn't know this day was coming. I slice the piece of jagged glass across her face. She screams. I turn and bolt down the hall. Dee Dee drove. In terms of distance, it wasn't far from the nightclub to South Boston. Through narrow, winding streets and way too many red lights, she careened, fishtailed, and flashed her lights. Keynes gripped the oh-shit handle above the door but didn't say a word. She found her way to the tenement housing from memory. Once upon a time, in the days of Whitey Bulger, this section of Boston had belonged to the Irish. It had been a hub of gangland activity, drugs, and poverty. In the 1990s, however, rent control had ended, forcing many low-income families from the area, while the demand for waterfront real estate led to a nearly overnight gentrification. But before there could be progress, first there had to be demo.
which had been long and ongoing, with at least one stretch of boarded-up former tenement houses shuttered away behind a chain-link fence, still awaiting its fate. She came to the fencing first, drove around looking for a gate, discovered two other patrol cars already parked in front. An officer looked up as she pulled in, held up a chain in front of her headlights, enough for her to see the padlock was missing, meaning they weren't the first people to be accessing the property. Dee Dee killed her lights, then she and Keynes climbed out of the car, approached the other officers. She could hear sirens in the distance, other units responding to the call. She frowned. Currently, Natalie Draga was holed up with at least two kidnapping victims. Broadcast the police's approach and she might spook, leading to a hostage situation or worse. This would have to be a stealth operation all the way, like the SWAT team raid against Jacob Ness, who hadn't had a clue until the first tear gas canister shattered his motel window. Dee Dee got on the radio, made the call. 30 seconds later, the distant sirens cut off abruptly, and only the sound of the approaching engines remained. Better. She gathered the four officers. One of them reported having found an abandoned taxi just up the street. Otherwise, all appeared quiet, and they had yet to see anyone enter the property. Dee Dee nodded. The abandoned housing project was large. 6, 7 massive brick buildings, all featuring boarded-up windows and crumbling facades. God knew about structural integrity, let alone what else they'd find inside. Squatters, drug addicts, rodents of all sizes. This would take finesse. We'll work in teams of two. Start at the perimeter, work your way to the center. Classic grid search. Look for any trace of light coming from the edges of a window, footprints in the dust, recently disturbed entrances, picked locks, that sort of thing. Don't approach on your own, just recon. We have at least two victims trapped somewhere inside and a suspect with nothing to lose. We need to control the situation first, not escalate. Officers nodded, snapped on flashlights, and prepared to enter. Dee Dee walked back with Keynes to her vehicle. She kept her voice low. Wanna wait in the car? No. Got a vest? I'm hoping you have a spare. She paused. You have any fieldwork training? She asked. Yes. Because, she stumbled over the words, couldn't help herself. I'm on restricted duty. I don't have a sidearm. I can shoot, though. I mean, I've been practicing. Just the standard two-handed stance is a little tricky with my shoulder right now, but straight on I can do it. I can. He seemed to understand what she was saying. I have a backup piece, .38. Trade you for my shotgun? Makes sense. She popped open the trunk of her vehicle, where she had supplies for tactical situations, including an extra vest and a gun locker. So, he said conversationally as they geared up, a wounded detective and a federal Ph.D. Best cavalry ever, she assured him. We'd better get it right, because the paperwork alone will make us both wish we were dead. Dee Dee smiled, tried to pretend her hands weren't shaking. What had Phil said? She needed to rely more on her team? Well, she'd communicated. This wasn't her entering alone. She had officers in front, a Phoebe at her side, and backup on its way. She was learning. Adapting. Still, taking Keynes's .38, a gun that used to feel so natural in her grasp. She pictured Jack. She pictured Alex. She promised herself she'd return home to them soon enough. Then she followed Keynes into the abandoned housing complex. Chapter 48. The first bullet wings over my shoulder. I duck reflexively, veering right as drywall explodes to my left. A second shot, third, fourth. She's laughing as she pulls the trigger. Maybe not even aiming, but enjoying the show as I dart right, then left, then right, flinching and ducking. I resist the urge to look over my shoulder to see how close I am to impending death. Instead, I keep on trucking, bare feet pounding down the debris-littered corridor. In self-defense class, a teacher had advised us to flee if ever confronted by someone with a gun. Apparently, it's astonishingly difficult to hit a moving target. At least, your odds of survival are higher running from a shooting gunman than, say, getting into a car with him and driving to a remote location where he can do exactly what he wants. So I sprint, chest heaving, elbows tucked tight, head ducked low, trying to make myself a smaller target.
My foot hits something sharp, then something stabbing. There's no time to pause, pick out slivers of wood, or worse, pieces of glass. I keep on running, transitioning from a relatively domesticated section of the building to some kind of construction zone, the smell of dust and neglect heavier in the air. The hall is too dark for me to see where I'm going or adjust my footsteps to avoid the sharpest objects. More shots fired. I run for my life. Doorway to the right. I careen through it without a second thought, intent on getting out of the line of fire. Only afterward does it occur to me it might be a bedroom, or worse, a bathroom, a room with no exit where I'd be trapped. But in this case it appears to be yet another common room. I've given up on my theory of being trapped in a traditional Boston triple-decker. The structure is too vast, too many hallways, too many rooms. Not a warehouse or commercial building because the rooms are small. Maybe a group home? Abandoned? Undergoing renovations? Something. I should stop, get my bearings, but I can't think anymore. I sprint down dark hallways, leap through dark spaces, like a deer through the woods. I might be crying, which is stupid. Last thing I need to do right now is make any undue noise. I crash through another doorway, step on something sharp, and feel it slice deeply into the ball of my foot. I can't help myself. I draw up short, hopping on one leg, biting my lower lip against the screen. Belatedly, I flatten myself against the wall, will myself to stand still, breathe, think, breathe. I can't keep running pell-mell through a maze of sharp objects and unknown spaces, waiting to become trapped, shot, killed. I need to come up with a strategy. Something worthy of taking on a homicidal maniac armed with a gun. A woman who's been waiting 5 years to destroy me. Though, to be fair, I've been waiting 5 years to kill her, too. My breathing is ragged. I force myself to inhale deeply, try to smooth out my racing pulse so I can listen for the sound of approaching footsteps. Then I concentrate on thinking. Lindy. She's here, in Boston. She tracked me down, visited my mother's farm, found me at Devin Goulding's house, then followed me back to my highly secure apartment, where she broke in using my landlord's keys. Neat trick, that. It had never occurred to me that for all my extra bolts, my landlord's would remain the weak link. But yes, their own approach to locking up is haphazard at this stage of their lives, and once she had their keys... Lindy, in my apartment. Lindy bringing me back here to finish what Jacob had started. I want her dead. The flatness of the thought, the direct, compelling need, grounds me, further calms my breathing. I've hated her since the first time I saw Jacob watching her, since she threw her arms around him in welcome, since they sat on the sofa, heads nearly touching. Then her forcing me to go out, approach that woman in the bar. I don't think about that night, or any of the others that followed. I don't talk about her, Jacob, what they made me do. No, I save those memories for my nightmares, where all these years later I still wake up screaming. Jacob made me roll the bodies from his rig to the marshy grass alongside the road. Then he made me sit and watch till the gators discovered the unexpected treats. He never said a word, just watched me with eyes that told me some day this would be my fate. Except Lindy would be the one to roll my body out the door, and she'd be clapping gleefully as the local wildlife came to feed. Lindy, here in Boston. Lindy, somewhere in the dark behind me. When I took the first self-defense class, I'm sure my mother assumed it was the Jacobs of the world I was practicing taking down. I never corrected her. Never told her that every time I blocked and kicked, it was a slightly older, astonishingly beautiful opponent I pictured in my head. That when I handled my first firearm, it was her face I imagined as the target. I've been practicing killing Lindy for 5 years now. Each time I set out on a mission, I even told myself that if I could pull this off, maybe it would mean I was ready for Florida. Except, of course, I never quite accepted that answer. There was always one more thing for me to attend to up here. Then, of course, Stacy Summers. I couldn't just leave Stacy Summers. Now here I am. I don't have to find Lindy after all. Lindy has found me. And I'm a shaking, quivering mass all over again. She has a gun. I have a jagged piece of window glass. She is Lindy. And I'm not Molly. I have to remind myself. Not Molly, not Molly, not Molly. Except, of course, I feel that helpless all over again. I need a plan. Kill Lindy, slay the beast, and maybe, maybe I can come home again and bring Stacy Summers with me. I don't think of the motel room anymore. I don't think of that final day, the weight of Jacob's gun in my hand, the echo of my promise in his ear, or the sticky feel of his brains in my hair. I picture my mom, the way she looked standing in my kitchen the other morning, proud and resigned, caring and reserved, the mother who still loves me, even knowing her daughter has never truly returned. I want to go home now. I want to throw my arms around my mother in her ridiculous flannel shirts. I want to hug her. And even if it doesn't feel like how it felt before, I want to appreciate how it feels now. I don't want to survive anymore. I want to live. There, I hear it. Footsteps, slow and shuffling down the hall behind me. Lindy is approaching, no doubt with the gun held before her, finger on the trigger. Resources? I have a sharp piece of glass, already wet with her blood. I have elbows and knees and an excellent kick. Glancing around the shadowed space, I don't see any sign of furniture but dark piles of random garbage, which could prove interesting. After all, trash has saved me before. I pull myself up, prepare to sort through the piles. I have it together now. I'm not tired, I'm not hungry, nor cold, nor in pain. I'm okay. And I'm about to do what I do best. Whatever it takes to survive. Dee Dee pulled up short, her hand on Keynes's arm as she turned toward the sound. "There," she whispered as the sharp crack sounded again. "Gunfire." "Second building to the right," Keynes murmured. She illuminated it with her flashlight, a hulking structure of faded brick and boarded-up windows. She didn't see any light peering around the plywood eyes. But then, just as she was about to turn to the next building, three more shots in rapid succession. "Definitely that building," she agreed. She adjusted her grip on the .38. They made their approach. Chapter 49. Did you ever hear the martial arts masters brag, "I know 10 ways to kill someone with a drinking straw, 12 if you include the paper wrapper"? According to my instructor, this is more hyperbole than fact. What's the point of being the master of anything if you can't sound very, very scary? A plastic straw, however, can be a useful weapon. I found one in the pile of garbage closest to me. I bent it in half, then tucked it between the index and middle finger of my left hand. Folded, the straw is sharp enough and rigid enough to make a decent jabbing weapon. Catch an opponent in the eye, or better yet, slam into the hyoid bone at the front of the throat, and you can inflict some damage. How much, I'm about to find out. I can hear Lindy creeping down the end of the corridor. So close I can make out the sound of her breathing. I picture her smiling, happy to be on the hunt once more. I never understood the full dynamics of her and Jacob's relationship. He loved her. I could tell that just by watching. And Lindy? She was excited to see him. But love? I don't know. I think of Lindy as a sleek, dark panther stalking the night, aroused by the scent of blood. Does such a creature truly love? I think she loved how special Jacob made her feel, how powerful and strong. When he appeared, hunting was twice the fun. I guess she thought the same of the bartender with the amazing pecs, Devin Goulding, the guy I watched burn to death in front of my eyes, the memory of which makes me feel powerful and strong. No one wants to be a monster. And yet, here we are. I expect Lindy to lead with her weapon. The gun will appear first, followed by her arm, and in that unprotected moment I will lash out with the glass, aiming for her wrist, the back of her hand. One deep slash, she'll reflexively drop her firearm, and then we'll be on a level playing field. Of course, she's too smart for that. When she finally appears beside me in the doorway, she has her elbows glued tight to her ribs, gun tucked to her chest, a human wall, presenting only the side of her shoulder for attack. Even if I got her with my glass dagger, it would be a glancing blow, nothing serious. I hold my breath, will her to take one more step into the room, Then I'll kick out with my left foot, go for the side of her knee. I am not tired, not hungry, not cold, not in pain. I am in the zone, where I can kill another human being and feel just fine about it. I think, in that moment, it would be best if my mother never touched me again, because the daughter she misses is a happy girl who loves foxes, and I am someone else. I am something else. Lindy steps into the room. I kick just as she twists toward me, her teeth flashing white in the dark. She's already bringing the gun forward, clearly having known exactly where I was standing, exactly what I was planning. What neither of us can predict, however, is that my missed kick throws me off balance, sending me careening into her, collapsing onto her form. We crash to the floor, and I have a weird sense of deja vu. We are in her dingy little house. I have the kitchen knife. Gun. Gun. She has the gun, trapped between us. Pointed at her, pointed at me. I'm not sure either of us know. I can't afford to roll away, which would give her the room to aim. But tangled up in each other, I can't effectively jab or stab. We wrestle instead, her determined not to drop the gun, me determined not to lose my broken glass or plastic straw. I smell blood, hers from her slashed cheek, mine from my lacerated feet, then pain, sharp and piercing, her teeth biting into my ear, grinding, pulling, tugging. In response, I twist my right hand, rake the shard of glass down her side, then twist it cruelly. Neither of us gasp or scream or cry out. We are intent. This is serious business. But just for a second, I think I hear something in the distance. She bites me again, chomps, chews, does her best Mike Tyson. I can't afford to care about her teeth. The gun is the problem. I need to get the gun away from her. Rolling across the dusty floor, trying to bring my left hand up, I still have the bent straw wedged between my fingers. Now I punch it, best that I can, into her throat. We're too close, inside each other's kill zones. Once again, I dig in with my makeshift weapon. Even if I can't take a backswing for effective strike force, I can poke, press, scratch, and claw. She gurgles as the straw jabs deep into her windpipe, interfering with her ability to draw air. I shove harder, determined to capitalize on the advantage. She wedges both hands between us, forcefully shoves me away. I fall to the side. Realize immediately I gotta move, move, move. The slightest twist on her part, a single pull of the trigger. I thrust with my right hand, scoring the shard of glass down her arm, the back of her hand. Us on the floor, fighting for the kitchen blade. She gasps, flinches. I slash again and again, my fingers growing slippery with blood. And she laughs, breathlessly, excitedly, because this is what she likes. This is what she wants. There's no pain for her, only pleasure. I am merely Flora 2.0. She is beyond Jacob, beyond any of us. The monster other monsters fear. She will get the kitchen knife. She will drive it deep into my chest, but only after having some fun first. Then my body will be fed to the gators, never to be recovered, while Jacob goes out, snatches another girl, and starts the whole process all over again. Stacy Summers collapsed upstairs in desperate need of medical attention. My mother, no doubt standing in my kitchen right now, baking, 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 while she once again awaits word of her daughter. I don't want to die in this house any more than I wanted to die in a coffin-shaped box. I accept that I'm not a good person or a happy person. I realize I can't find peace walking through the woods of my childhood. I understand that I no longer know how to return my mother's hug. But somewhere deep inside, I still believe that one day I might be that person again. That just because I've turned into a monster doesn't mean that one day I won't change back again and be the girl my mother and brother both miss. Someday I might find myself again. Noises in the distance, the groaning wrench of plywood, hard pounding footsteps. Beside me, Lindy stills, listening as well. Her gunshots have drawn notice. Others are coming, most likely the police, SWAT officers with tear gas. If I can just buy time, they will save me again. Except, Lindy twists back at me. I stare at her. And we both know what has to happen next. Because this isn't about outsiders. This is, has to be, about her and me. My right hand slashes down with the shard of glass. Her arms pop up, absorbing the strike just long enough to level the gun. I follow with my left fist, plastic straw still tight beneath my fingers, as I punch it hard into the side of her neck. Her wheezing gasp, a suspended moment of time. "I told him I'd kill you," I whisper. "That last day, tears and snot smeared all over his face, I told him I'd kill you next." She opens her mouth. I think she's going to laugh again. Instead, she pulls the trigger. I hear the sound as if from far, far away. I feel the